This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Margaret, this week brought some interesting news on the innovation front. We've been strong champions of the need to focus on healthcare delivery, not just health insurance, throughout this long year of health reform. And we're seeing some of that happen. Dartmouth College just announced the creation of the new Dartmouth Center for Health Delivery Science, dedicated to the science of healthcare delivery.
Well, Dartmouth has been in the healthcare news this year quite a bit. That New Yorker article by Dr. Atul Gawande focused the nation's attention on geographic disparities in cost without any association with quality. And that work results from the Dartmouth Atlas Project, which is part of Dartmouth's Institute of Health Policy and Clinical Practice. Now their new center for the healthcare delivery science seems to make northern New Hampshire and Hanover something of an epicenter for healthcare, wouldn't you say?
It certainly does. Two things really stood out for me. One was the bipartisan support the center had, which seemed to demonstrate again that good ideas will often trump partisan politics. Republican Senator Greg Judd opposed the health reform legislation, but has been a big supporter of the new center. The second is the statement by Dartmouth President Dr. Kim that they hope to make the state of New Hampshire a pilot state of innovation. We've been saying for years that America has 50 laboratories called states, and that's where innovation can best be done.
And, you know, Mark, Dr. Kim has a tremendous background in both healthcare delivery and innovation and in education. I bet we'll want to have him on our show one day. I thought one thing he said really got to the heart of the issue. A lot of schools teach health policy, but they don't really teach the complexity of what it takes to actually build effective, functioning healthcare delivery systems.
As interesting as it is to focus on delivery systems, we're going to put our attention on the health insurance industry this week. In recent weeks, we've seen Congress and HHS try to steer the industry towards reform, even in advance of the implementation of health reform legislation. One of the country's oldest and largest insurers is Aetna, and the company's president, Mark Bertolini, joins us today to talk about the role Aetna played in the health reform discussions as it evolved and how it will respond to the challenges of increased transparency, accountability, and cost containment. We're happy you can join us today.
And on an unrelated note, let us wish the University of Connecticut national champion women's basketball team a hearty congratulations. They were at the White House this week to meet with President Obama. And we understand the planned pickup game of basketball, sadly, was canceled due to rain. But we send our congratulations.
We do. Go Huskies, and I'm sure they'll be back next year. No matter what the story, you can hear all of our shows on our website, chcradio.com. You can subscribe to iTunes to get our show regularly downloaded. Or if you would like to hang on to our every word and read a transcript of one of our shows, come visit us at chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have feedback, email us at chcradio.com. We'd love to hear from you. Now, before we speak with Mark Bertolini, let's check in with our producer, Lauren Bonner, with the headline news.
I'm Lauren Bonner with this week's headline news. The Obama administration has moved quickly to jumpstart a key initiative under health reform, encouraging more small businesses to provide health insurance coverage for their workers. In hopes of doing that, the administration announced that it has sent government postcards to eligible small businesses across the country, letting them know about the tax credits. To qualify, the IRS said companies must pay at least 50% of their workers' premiums, have fewer than 25 employees, and pay an average salary of less than $50,000 a year for each employee. Rising health care costs have been the biggest concern for small businesses for decades, and many firms are particularly worried about the impact of new fines under the legislation that fail to provide their workers with coverage. The number of firms eligible for the new tax credits is still unclear, although the administration is saying it could be up to 4 million businesses. The White House and First Lady Michelle Obama were back in the news for their campaign against obesity. The White House Task Force on Childhood Obesity released its report to the president titled "Solving the Problem of Childhood Obesity Within a Generation," which details recommendations for action. The campaign is also gaining important support in the form of an agreement between the Partnership for a Healthier America, a group formed by a number of the nation's leading foundations, and the Healthy Weight Commitment Foundation, a group formed by more than 80 of the nation's largest retailers. To solve the obesity problem within a generation, the plan has 70 recommendations in 5 areas: early childhood, empowering parents and caregivers, healthy foods in schools, access to affordable healthy food, and more physical activity. 16 of the private corporations that are part of the Healthy Weight Commitment Foundation pledged to cut 1.5 trillion calories from the food they sell by the end of 2015 and 1 trillion calories by 2012 by changing recipes, reducing portion sizes, and other strategies. Melody Barnes, the White House domestic policy advisor who submitted the report to the president, said the critical goal was getting everyone on board.
The federal government can't do this alone. That we had to work together with the private sector, with the philanthropic sector, with parents, with community advocates, with absolutely everyone who has a stake in ensuring that children are leading healthy and balanced lives.
To ensure that the Healthy Weight Commitment Foundation stands by this pledge, the partnership will monitor progress on an annual basis, and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation will serve as an independent evaluator. This week, Conversations on Healthcare explores the topic of accountability and transparency in our healthcare system, particularly as it relates to the insurance industry. While healthcare reform will mandate changes, some companies have already started down this road. One small example was Aetna's announcement in 2005 that it would be the first health insurance company to provide consumers with online access to rates for doctor visits, a missing piece of the consumer healthcare decision-making process. The Department of Health and Human Services has also been pushing for more data and price transparency. Through the Open Government Initiative, HHS is making vast stores of data available to the public. Todd Park, Chief Technology Officer at HHS, says this shift to a more open government is essential to meeting all the challenges HHS is taking on in transforming the healthcare system.
You know, I can't imagine doing any of those things without disseminating information to the public, you know, without actually engaging citizens from all walks of life in the great challenges that they present, without collaborating with academia and businesses and not-for-profits and folks from all over. I think that transparency, participation, collaboration are essential to how our American government should work in the 21st century to improve the health and well-being of the American people.
For instance, the new interactive Centers for Medicare and Medicaid dashboard allows the public access to analyze Medicare spending, and the latest effort is being called the Community Health Data Initiative. It's an ongoing collaboration among the public, as well as government and non-government partners, with the goal of establishing and utilizing a trove of community health data. Its purpose is to help Americans understand health and the performance of the healthcare system in their communities, thereby sparking action to improve it. Park says it's exciting to contemplate citizens joining arm in arm to try and better the health of their community.
We've got a lot of data that actually articulates how we're doing as a country, as states, as counties, with respect to measures like obesity and smoking, with respect to determinants of health and well-being, like access to healthy food, et cetera. And so what we actually are going to do is just very simply take all that data, make sure that it doesn't compromise individual privacy, and release it in a structured, standardized form that is free of charge to the public. And what we're then doing is actually effectively trying to market that data to not-for-profits and companies and research organizations, et cetera, to take that data and turn it into super cool applications and mashups and programs that could help citizens gain a better understanding of community health, to help put pressure on decision makers, and to help facilitate and improve performance.
The amount of time it will take to begin using the data in a useful, meaningful way is still to be determined. To get the ball rolling, the Sunlight Foundation, an education organization that increases transparency in Congress, recently launched the Design for America competition, which will give $5,000 to someone who comes up with the best visualization of community health data. Let's listen now to the interview with Mark Bertolini, president of Aetna, to learn more about how his company and the private insurance industry is responding to the challenges and opportunities created by national health reform legislation.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. Today we're speaking with Mark Bertolini, president of Aetna, one of the nation's leading insurance companies. Welcome, Mark. Aetna's rebuilt its reputation as a health insurer in recent years by focusing on working with providers across the country to control cost and improve quality. You've worked closely with physicians to do that, but also developed disease management programs and wellness programs. What are some of the programs at Aetna that are aimed at incentivizing wellness and prevention, as well as quality and efficiency in healthcare? And as you look down the road, is there something beyond pay-for-performance that we can look for?
I think what you're going to find is creating incentives for both consumers and providers to have a conversation. Because most importantly, and I think, you know, Americans inherently are shoppers, most importantly, when the information's available for both consumers and providers to have a conversation, they can have a very full conversation about both the quality and the cost of the services they're buying. And today we don't have that as readily available, that transparency. And I think what we hope to engender is a level of understanding and conversation between the physician and the consumer about how they ought to think about the appropriate use of healthcare services.
Mark, over the past year or two, Aetna promoted its 10 principles for health reform. These principles included the individual mandate to have insurance, also tax credits for businesses, expanding public insurance eligibility, and that real focus on prevention and wellness. So when you look at the final legislation and compare it to the Aetna principles, where do you see an alignment, and where do you think it differs from what you had hoped to see?
So I think it's a great start. Access is the most important thing, and we did get an individual coverage requirement, and we did get a tax credit for small employers as a way to help them get coverage. What we're concerned about is that we think the individual coverage requirement penalty isn't significant enough to create economic indifference between having insurance and not having insurance. So there's some danger there in people going in and out of the system when they get sick to buy insurance, mm-hmm. because it will be a guaranteed issue environment. That means they'll be able to get health care insurance when they want it. And probably more importantly is that the 10 points we had in there also talked a lot about the affordability of healthcare. So access is indeed the first and foremost important issue to address, but we very quickly need to move on to affordability, because underlying the rise of insurance premiums over the last decade have been the rise in the underlying cost of healthcare.
This is certainly a very interesting period for insurance industries, and we're seeing pressure from the Department of Health and Human Services towards insurance companies to justify rate increases and to establish minimum claim loss ratios. How will these and other plan regulations affect your industry, and what might both consumers and providers see in changes as a result?
Well, I think, again, we're going to see greater transparency, right? So if we have, you know, rate reviews, I think you'll see greater transparency, greater awareness on the part of consumers. You should know that every rate we file with every insurance department, we have a conversation between their actuary and our actuary.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been an ongoing review that we've always done as a matter of course of business. So a bit of this is politics at play, more than really good policy.
Do you think this will dissipate in terms of HHS's review, and you'll still work with the states, or do you think HHS is permanently embedded now in your rate review process?
No, I don't. I think it's always going to be states. I'm not quite sure what HHS will really be able to do around rate when the states really handle the rate filings and the rate approvals. So we're very focused on the states. I've been talking with all the insurance commissioners over the last week about, you know, MLR, minimum MLR, how do we get it done right. I think the focus is now quickly moving away from vilifying the insurance industry and getting a reform bill done to, okay, now how do we actually make it work?
Mm-hmm. So, Mark, speaking of conversations, one of the kind of painful conversations we watched unfold on C-SPAN was the grilling that an executive, I think it was of Anthem, got from one of the congressional committees on the subject of both rate hikes and executive compensation. But the reality of any publicly traded company is that it has this primary responsibility to return value to the shareholders, both in short-term and in long-term value. And this is a point that the single-payer community certainly made over and over early on. on in the health reform debates. How does Aetna ask the public to reconcile this obligation of returning profits to shareholders with the demand at the same time for more affordable premiums and more extensive coverage of benefits and services?
That's a great question. I love that question because we do not give our profits to our shareholders. And that's one of the greatest misunderstandings that occurs in every bit of this conversation about not-for-profit and for-profit. Mm-hmm. The only difference between a not-for-profit and a for-profit is that we pay taxes. Every for-profit and every not-for-profit takes its earnings and reinvests them in their business. Our shareholders make money by trading shares between the shareholders. But that value of the share is largely determined by how we reinvest our earnings in growing the business and making the business more valuable. So I'm not taking my profit dollars and writing a check out to my shareholders every year. They're trading between one another. And if you talk to any good not-for-profit organization, talk to the Ascension Health System, the largest not-for-profit health company in the world, and they will tell you if you don't generate a sufficient margin to reinvest in your business, you cannot survive over the long haul.
I think it's the Sisters of Charity who said if there's no margin, there's no mission.
That's the Daughters of Charity.
Daughters of Charity, yes.
10% operating margin.
Yeah.
I'd kill for that.
There's been an enormous attention to the Dartmouth Atlas of Healthcare Studies showing a disconnect between healthcare expenses and the quality and variations by geographic region. As a national company with access to tremendous data and capability for analysis, and you mentioned earlier we're a country of shoppers, but how is your company and the industry as a whole using this data to advance both quality and healthcare cost containment?
First of all, understanding what the data really means is very important. You know, for example, in San Francisco, a routine colonoscopy can cost anywhere between $1,250 and $7,300. Why? I can't quite describe why. And so part of it is just knowing. The second part then is to say, where does quality really, really matter? And how differentiated is that quality between providers that substantiates the reason why they can charge higher rates? And so while one institution may be the best transplant institution in any geography or region, it doesn't mean that their lab rates and their x-ray rates should be the highest rates in the community as well. And so as we go forward, our intent is to show these differences to consumers. We just launched a new tool called the Member Payment Estimator that allows our members to go online, put in their doctor, put in their institution, put in their procedure, and get the charge that institution or that whole procedure will cost, get what will get reimbursed to the provider, and see their own out-of-pocket expenses because we real-time adjudicate that claim against their current file, including their current out-of-pocket and deductible expense. That then allows us to put together benefit plans that cause people to go look at that and say, okay, it's important for me to understand this before I go so I understand what my out-of-pocket expenses are.
So a new era of transparency, which we welcome. And a question for you, Mark, the principles of the patient-centered medical home, that's really taken quite a center stage as a strategy to improve health outcomes and control costs. Aetna has been a significant player in states like Pennsylvania. They have worked on system redesigns that help the practices transform and do a better job of managing chronic diseases. In your opinion, passing fad, or do you see real long-term gain to the patient-centered medical home as an approach that might deliver on better outcomes and lower costs?
I think it's a necessary experiment at this time to understand how we best meet the needs of an ever-growing demand for physicians and physician-like services. So if you think it's difficult in a major metropolitan area to get a primary care visit today, wait till we put 32 million more people into the system. And so I think the issue is not necessarily how do I get access to a doctor, but how do I get access to services? And the patient-centered medical home is a concept broader than the doctor. It includes a scope of practice that goes beyond the physician, includes clinical nurse practitioners, physician assistants, and other ancillary providers that allow for the system to take better care of people and get them better access so they don't end up in the emergency room where they don't wait too long. And I think that a step beyond the patient-centered medical home will be accountable care organizations, which will be the broader concept of the physician's role in the broader healthcare delivery infrastructure.
Today we're speaking with Mark Bertolini, president of Aetna. As you mentioned, an analyst agree with you that the health reform legislation represents a boon for private insurers, certainly for the recipients of coverage. There's an expectation of a flood of new customers driven by both the individual mandate, the availability of insurance for people previously denied coverage due to pre-existing conditions. And what's Aetna doing in terms of the development of primary care providers across the country? I know you're not a provider of care, but you're concerned about it. You mentioned it earlier. There may not be access because we don't have enough primary care physicians out there.
Well, I think we need to change the way the system gets paid in order to encourage the development of more primary care physicians. But I will tell you, we could graduate every medical school class for the next decade and not have enough primary care physicians. So we're going to have to look at scope of practice in a broader set of healthcare providers in order to get people appropriate access to care over the next decade.
Do you have a plan on that? You know, obviously there are PAs and APRNs who are engaged in a full scope of coverage. Are you thinking RNs? Where are you drawing the line in terms of changes that might be out there?
Well, in some states you can have, you know, pharmacists prescribe medication.
Mm-hmm.
And so should we look at the scope of practice laws in each state and based on capacity expand those scope of practice wherever we can? So it would be our intent to think about how we can support that. In addition, again, how people get paid has an impact on what they choose as a specialty when they come out of medical school. And so we have to really struggle with and wrestle to the ground this difficult issue of how we pay for services.
Mark, a question we'd like to ask our guests. As you look around the country and the world, what do you see in terms of innovation that excites you, and who should our listeners at Conversations be keeping an eye on?
Well, I think the whole development of social media is an incredible opportunity for us. I know a lot of people are afraid of it. I actually use Twitter and all those services, and I think there's a real opportunity to take those new technologies to create communities of individuals who can communicate with one another about how to be well and how to feel better. And so instead of pushing brochures or having nurses call people, create communities where individuals with injuries or with chronic illnesses can get together and talk about what works for them. And so I think social media is an incredibly positive development. We're also very actively involved in the whole mobile app technology and how that's moving ahead. It's amazing how quickly that's evolving in healthcare. And if you think about how you interact with the rest of the world, you know, I can get my stuff from drugstore.com delivered to my home, and I can follow the package every day along its journey. It's kind of fun to watch it. You get the, you know, the tracking thing, and you can see when your package comes to your house. Today, we can't move an echocardiogram from one physician to another or from one hospital to another.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like the technology is not the issue. It's really the behavior of the people using the technology. So getting technology advances, I think, are going to be incredible innovations in the healthcare industry. They're going to make things a lot easier for people in the future in getting access to care and getting the best quality care, most importantly.
Today, we've been speaking with Mark Bertolini, president of Aetna. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks. Great to be with you.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. This week's bright idea focuses on a new online system that's transforming the way medical schools and hospitals prepare doctors and nurses for real-life emergencies. The system is called Second Life. It's an online program that runs simulation trainings for nearly every medical emergency imaginable. Here's how hospitals design virtual replicas of their real-life facilities so they can practice handling emergencies in places that they work on a daily basis. Participants interact in this virtual world via video game personas known as avatars. They respond to emergencies, everything from heart attacks to influenza outbreaks, just as they would in real life. But the virtual setting allows them to make mistakes and learn from them without the real-world consequences. Instructors have extensive control over the simulations, so they can really test the participants. They can completely control the patient avatars and can also toy with externals, such as weather, to cause additional problems like power outages. Second Life's creators believe the program is particularly well-suited for this generation of health professionals, many of whom have been computer-savvy gamers since adolescence. Second Life provides students with a much more comprehensive and realistic training experience by improving the performance of prospective and current physicians and increasing the efficiency of hospitals where they work. Second Life is transforming the way schools and hospitals approach training and quality control. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of Wesleyan University at WESU, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.